Okay, good morning, everybody. For the record, my name is Rex Kim, Chief Investment Officer of the Oregon State Treasury. In thinking about this April OIC meeting, I knew it would feel different for me as I moved from council member to Treasury staff. However, I did not expect it to feel this different. We are very happy to have the technology that allows us to host today's meeting, but it's new territory for us, and there may be some hiccups. But before proceeding with today's meeting, I would like to make a few comments about our format today. First of all, to be clear, this meeting today is being recorded, and the audio portion along with materials will be posted on the Treasury website. Second, there is a closed captioning option available. It's at the bottom of the screen. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. And also, we are also open to providing a sign language interpreter at future meetings. If this is of interest to you, please reach out to us. Next, if you are having any kind of technical difficulties, please use the Ask a Question box on the right side of your screen. Our IT team is on standby to respond. And lastly, very importantly, in regards to public comments, we will be requesting that you submit those via writing. You could submit those using the same question box, or you could use email or regular mail. We're always appreciative of these comments, so we would love to hear from you. Thank you to everyone participating, everyone listening in, as we host our very first virtual OIC meeting. We thank you for your patience and your feedback, and we'll try to make improvements to this format so that these meetings are good use of your time. With that, Chair Russell, the meeting is yours.
Good. That actually is not a virtual gavel, that's the real gavel. I'm John Russell, the Chair of the Oregon Investment Council, and I'd like to call the meeting to order. The first order of business is a roll call. We have to do this virtually. Treasurer Reed?
Here.
Knowledge is here. Council Member Moss?
Here.
Council Member Samples?
I am here.
Good. And Mr. Olenek? Not here, but the quorum of the council is present. Let me follow up on Rex's comments. Clearly, this is a brave new world in so many different respects for each of us individually and as a group. We're doing virtual meetings. We're talking about investments in one of the most volatile markets in the history of the country. But we have one major change. And that is Council Member Rex Kim, who was hired by the Treasurer as our new Chief Investment Officer. With Council Member endorsement, believe me. My personal view, it was a brilliant move by the Treasurer. Any sort of a search in normal times is lengthy. In this case, it would be doing virtual interviews. Rex clearly has earned the trust and the respect of all the other members on the council and the staff. So I wonder if there's such a thing as a virtual applause for welcoming Rex. But you can probably hear me applaud. So anyway, thank you and welcome. First order of business is to review and approve the minutes of the last meeting. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes of our March 11th meeting as presented.
Is there a second?
A second.
Patricia, I'll second.
Seconded by Council Member Moss. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
I think, May, you heard. Okay, good. Good. So, next is a special officer election. Treasurer Reed.
Mr. Chair, I would certainly associate myself with your remarks about former Council Member Kim, now Chief Investment Officer Kim. It does feel a little strange as the three of us sit here at the extreme edges and the center of the dais, but it's nice to see Rex and you, Mr. Chair, and everyone, all the other three people in the room at safe distances. This new configuration does mean we need a new vice chair, and I'm happy to nominate Patricia Moss to serve as your vice chair.
I'm willing to second that if that's approved. All those in favor of electing Patricia Mox as our new vice chair, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Good. Approved.
And thank you, Councilmember Moss. I'm glad you didn't oppose that or vote no.
Yeah. So, Mr. Kim.
All right, for the record, Rex Kim, Chief Investment Officer. Members of the OIC, I am truly appreciative of your confidence in me. This is an exciting moment for me, joining you today as CIO. It was Henry David Thoreau who once wrote, "Go confidently in the direction of your dreams. Live the life you've imagined." Over the past 4 years, while I served alongside all of you on the OIC, we approved many changes to the portfolios that separate us from others. Sometimes we look great. At other times, we lagged a bit. Recent market volatility is our latest challenge, a challenge to us all to remain confident and to continue the path that we've paved, a path founded on rigorous research and intellectual honesty, and a focus on the long term rather than the short term wins of the market sentiment. Thoreau wanted to be in isolation, whereas our isolation is due to a public health crisis. Luckily for us, we have technology that allows us to stay connected. I've had the great pleasure over these first few weeks of these virtual social get-togethers with staff. It's been one of our ways of making lemonade out of lemons. And it is during these virtual get-togethers that I've learned so much more about each of them. For example, I have learned that people like Dana Milliken and Eric Messer have strong opinions on the Oxford comma and the number of spaces after a period. As someone who earned his undergraduate degree in English literature, I am so glad that staff has appreciation for proper punctuation because "let's eat grandpa" is clearly not the same as "let's eat grandpa." This past month has been a struggle for the market, and it's been hard to hide from the volatility. I won't say too much on this topic now, as this is our primary agenda item for today. However, I did want to at least try to provide some comfort with the following. First, the changes to the portfolios over these several years provided support as planned. In particular, the increased allocation to treasuries provided positive performance over the first quarter, dampening the losses from equity beta. Second, we've got ample liquidity in the portfolio with near-term cash flow obligations being raised from the fixed income portfolio. And lastly, ultimately, the goal of this agenda item today is to better inform us in preparation for our conversation at the next meeting on asset allocation and also on capital markets assumptions. We have, for you, members of the OIC, two items for approval. We have a recommendation from staff on the real estate consultant and strategic policy for risk parity. From there, we will conclude with a look at the asset allocation and net asset values of all the portfolios and a peek into future meetings with the forward calendar. With all that is going on with COVID-19, I look forward to seeing all of you in person and also getting our rock band out for a live performance. And so before turning it back to you, Chair Russell, I would like to review the committee activities during the quarter. First off, to start, the Private Equity Committee approved the following investments: $30 million into Mayfield 16, $20 million into Mayfield Select 2, $250 million into Francisco Partners 6, $50 million into Francisco Partners Agility 2. And prior to his departure, CIO John Sherbaum approved an $11 million top-off into LS Power's Bolt Energy LLC. And with that, Chair Russell, I'll turn it back to you to see if there are any questions for me.
Any questions from Rex? Of Rex? Seeing none. Next item on the agenda is a presentation by Tony Brough on the real estate consultant recommendation.
Good morning. This is Tony Brough, Senior Investment Officer for the Real Estate Portfolio in Oregon State Treasury. I'll just do a quick sound check since I haven't had that yet.
That sounds great, Tony. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to confirm before I went too long. Good morning, Chair Russell, members of the Oregon Investment Council. Sitting here today before you in my virtual best suit and tie, I'm quite certain I wouldn't have guessed to be presenting to the OIC one day via my laptop. But that being said, I truly do look forward to presentations back in our boardroom and seeing each of you personally again shortly. This recommendation is for commencing a new contract term for the Council's real estate portfolio consultant. Per staff's memo, the current contract period with Makita, formerly known as Pension Consulting Alliance, or PCA for short, began in July of 2013, is now set to expire on June 30th of this year. With the support and assistance of OST's Chief Procurement Officer, a formal request for proposal was commenced in late August of 2019. 8 consultants that were capable of meeting the institutional requirements set forth in the RFP responded. The initial subgroup responsible for vetting these 8 respondent bidder lists include all 4 members of the real estate staff, which were myself, Austin Carmichael, Chris Ebersole, and Sam Spencer. The initial evaluation process resulted in 2 finalists being presented to formal RFP committee for in-person interviews, which were then conducted the first week of February 2020. In turn, the RFP committee identified Makita as the candidate recommendations to the OIC. By way of background, and as part of the selection consideration taken into account for the RFP committee, the proposed lead accountant representatives for consultant services on behalf of Makita will remain primarily unchanged, although it does contain 1 new individual based on Makita's Boston offices. With the merger of PCA, or OIC's former consultant, and Makita Investment Group in March of 2019, the firm now has a wider array of market coverage, regional and global office locations, and considerable depth of personnel. Additionally, the team at Makita held a pivotal role working with staff implementing the OPERF's real estate portfolio policy shift approved by the OIC in 2015. Retaining continuity of staffing and institutional knowledge within the portfolio is considered a positive attribute now that the real estate program has only recently completed its pivot towards creating a portfolio with more resilient income streams as part of a broader OPERF de-risking effort. Today's recommendation is to commence a new contract term beginning July 1, 2020 with Makita Investment Group for real estate portfolio consulting services. This is subject to successful legal negotiations of the contract document. With that as a backdrop, I now open the floor to any questions the council may have.
Any questions of Tony? Hearing none, I'd like to add, I was part of that brainstorming session, and I love brainstorming sessions, and I've been involved with them for years and years and years. That was one of the best that I've ever been involved with. Everybody had an opinion, and I think we came to a conclusion that everybody endorsed. So, is there a motion to accept the staff recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I move to approve or accept the staff recommendation.
Is there a second?
This is Member Kara Samples. I second.
Been moved and seconded to approve the staff recommendation. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 May, you got that? Good. Done. Thank you. Next on the agenda is Carl Cheng.
Great. Thank you, Chair Russell. For the record, Carl Cheng, Senior Investment Officer, Portfolio Risk and Research. I will provide just a quick introduction to what I think is a fairly straightforward topic. I am recommending for OIC approval a new governance policy for the recently established OPERP risk parity portfolio. The Council approved a 2.5% allocation to risk parity a year ago and subsequent investments in 3 risk parity strategies at the December and January meetings. Staff has nearly completed the onboarding process and will likely allocate capital to these strategies soon. To that end, I am asking for the Council's consideration of the proposed policy, IMD 610 Strategic Role of Risk Parity for OPERF. Besides establishing policy statements similar to those of some of the other asset class portfolios, the proposed policy will also set the S&P Risk Parity Index 12% target volatility as the policy benchmark for this portfolio. While there isn't a standardized approach to risk parity, the index is managed by a reputable index provider and is therefore a reasonable benchmark for the portfolio. That is the gist of my recommendation, and I am happy to answer any questions at this point.
Any questions of Carl? Is there a motion to...
I'll make a motion to approve it, and I think there's someone that doesn't have their phone on mute.
Mr. Chair, I second Member Moss's motion.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the staff recommendation. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Okay, you've got it. I would like to make a comment, and that is I think we need to keep the policy benchmark in mind. It's new, and this whole thing is new, and I think we ought to be flexible in the years to come about how that's dealt with. So that concludes the action items. The next is a presentation on the market environment review. Now, I understand Alan Emkin is the presenter at first.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, man.
Good. Great. Thank you. First and foremost, I wish everyone good health and good spirits. And it's worth repeating, but these are truly challenging times for everyone and all the stakeholders, both in the retirement system and the treasurer's office and society at large. My goal is to give a short presentation on perspective, and I will ask the staff to change the pages. So we go to page 2, please. And we have a line chart showing both the stock and bond markets over very long periods of time. The reason to show this is that over that very long period of time, the equity markets went through the Great Depression, the oil crisis, the S&L crisis, the tech bubble, and the global financial crisis, and somehow or other still came out long-term, trending positive, showing the resiliency of the American economy and the importance of modern capitalism. And I believe that there's no reason why that will not continue once this crisis is behind us. Turn the page, please. The next page does nothing more than provide you with a history of equity market declines and how long it took to recover. There's no question that when you're going through a decline, it is extremely painful. But history has proven time after time that the economy is resilient and that once the excesses or the issues are resolved, the trend is consistently positive. Over the last number of years, the fund and the Treasury Department have grown in their level of knowledge, sophistication, and tools. What was once a very small group managing large assets is much larger with much better tools, including state-of-the-art applications like the Aladdin software. Along with that, the board has adopted a whole array of policies and procedures in their oversight responsibilities, which facilitate the maximization on a risk-adjusted return of the investment portfolio to meet your stated purposes. The changes in policy, the growing knowledge and sophistication and tools of the staff result in the fund being well prepared both previously and now to address the challenges the portfolio faces. Page, please. This page shows the investment beliefs adopted by the board, excuse me, I will focus on only four of them. First and foremost is that asset allocation drives risk and return. Your board and staff have implemented a policy to be more diversified, and in fact, that diversification strategy has paid off handsomely with a low-risk real estate portfolio, a dedicated treasury portfolio, and a variety of diversifying investment strategies. The equity risk premium will be rewarded. You have and will continue to commit to equity-linked assets because it is only the equity-linked assets will generate the real rates of return necessary to fund benefits over time. An ongoing commitment to private markets, which is probably more important in today's world than ever before, because opportunities will present themselves and they will first become available in the private markets where significant discounts, we believe, will be presented. And that leads directly into the next one, and that is that there are inefficiencies that can be exploited, and your staff, your investment managers, and the board are very well prepared to take advantage of those. Page, please. All that being said, there are challenges. There's no frame of reference for what's going on with the virus. Nothing like this has happened in our lives, and it is a daily challenge because not only does it affect our business world and the financial markets, it affects our personal world. Very, very challenging. Valuations. Even though the market has gone down significantly, the equity market, so have earnings. So it's hard to believe, but still nothing appears cheap. And as public company earnings come in the near term, and unemployment numbers and GDP numbers are provided, valuations will continue to be stretched. The borrowing by central banks and governments globally is unprecedented, approaching or exceeding what happened during the Second World War at a time when revenues to state and local government are falling. This is something we really have to be concerned about and recognize. And the last two, nationalism and income inequality, are global public policy issues that hopefully will get resolved in a positive way, but that's currently not the trend. The Treasury, the staff, has proven their ability to take advantage of opportunities. The best example of that, in my opinion, was right at the end of the global financial crisis, a large commitment to bank loans, which proves highly accretive to the investment portfolio. Only taken after significant research and analysis and implemented thoughtfully, prudently, and to great success. Coinciding with that has been a long history of investing opportunistically in the private markets, taking advantage of dislocations as they occur. Last page, please. 2020 will go down as one of the most challenging, difficult, stressful periods in our investment careers and many of us in our personal lives. But as a long-term investor, we urge you to look at the silver lining, that there will be opportunities, that you have great resources, you have good policy, you have a wonderful staff, and there's no reason to believe anything other than over the long term, the portfolio will meet its objectives and come through this challenging period on top. Thank you very much. That's the end of my presentation.
And I'm told that Jim Callahan and Janet Becker-Wold will continue with the market environment review.
Indeed. Were there any questions for Alan before we start?
A question by Treasurer Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alan, thank you for the presentation. I was particularly interested in the way you talked about some of the new risks. And we, of course, have made some statements in our investment beliefs around ESG. And I was noticing your comment about income inequality. I wonder if you could, I'm thinking that that's probably in the context of the, maybe in the S, but I wonder if you could say a bit more about what you mean there.
The thank you for the question, Mr. Treasurer. The
Kevin Olin
is now joining.
The vitality and the strength of the society relies upon people's belief that there is an opportunity and the ability to compete in the marketplace for ideas and for gain. Sadly, what's happening right now is the impact of the virus is disproportionately impacted on a matter of wealth, and that will heighten the contradiction of the lack of income equality and opportunity, not just here, but in many parts of the world, and that will create a strain on governments and on public policy. And to the extent that that issue can be resolved in a favorable way, that will create more opportunity, more economic activity, and better political discourse than currently exists.
Thank
That's
you.
It.
And by the way, I'm told that Kevin Olenek, you're aboard?
Yes, I am. Thanks.
Okay. Good. Welcome. Any other questions of Alan? Hearing none, then. Jim and Janet, you're on.
Thank you very much, Chair Russell. And I want to join the council in welcoming Rex as the new CIO. We really look forward to working with him. And with that, I'll just go into our presentation. If you could just turn to page 2 of our presentation, which is page 26 of the board materials. And I don't have the video, so I'm going to assume it's up. The title is Snapshot, Volatile and Historic First Quarter of 2020. We wanted to kind of, we don't want to spend too much time talking about what happened, but I think it's really important to sort of frame these issues as Jim's going to follow up with some of the impacts of the market moves and the portfolio's positioning, the total funds positioning, and how it is going to kind of look when we come down with the first quarter performance. So in some of the changes, as Alan noted, and we'll go into a little more detail on when Jim gets to his portion, is that many of those changes, those de-risking, that the sort of de-risking of every asset class within the OPRF portfolio has really helped the fund hold up reasonably well over the quarter when things were really difficult. So this page shows kind of the performance of the S&P 500. It was down almost 20% for the quarter. You know, if you look at the peak to trough, it was down, you know, over 30%. So it was a pretty tough slide, and it happened very quickly, as you can see in the chart on the far right side. This is the long-term history. I'm sorry, it says 1 year, but it's clearly not 1 year. It goes back to 1996. But you can see that extremely sharp drop of the markets in March from the peak in February. And that is historic. It was 16 days to get to a market correction. So it was fast from peak to trough. So, and as Alan noted, and you can see in this chart, the little box there, which might be a little difficult to read, that valuations really haven't changed all that much. And that means, again, that there's, while the market is less expensive from a price perspective because of the earnings outlooks, especially in some segments of the market, valuations remain relatively high. They dropped below the median long-term average, and then when the markets rebounded post the lows in March, things kind of went back to the same valuations they were in February. So if you kind of peel back the onion a little bit in terms of what did well and what didn't do well during the quarter, tech stocks did well. Consumer staples did well, things that you need, technology, but the things that did really poorly were energy and financials. Energy was down over 50%, and that, as you know, has continued, and we'll talk a little bit about oil and its impact on the markets. It fell 66% during the quarter, and then it fell even further in April. We see the pretty dramatic outperformance of growth versus value across all market segments. And we're going to see some things going forward that could also impact returns, which is fewer buybacks because corporations will be conserving cash. And we'll probably see reductions, and we're already seeing reductions in the UK, of dividends being paid by banks. So there's an expectation that dividends will also fall. If we could please move to page 3. This chart just shows on the top the major pullbacks since in the S&P 500 index since the financial crisis in 2010. And you can see kind of coinciding with some of the market declines noted in the top chart, what the volatility did is noted by the VIX index, which is a volatility index for the S&P 500. And you can see the spike here, and this chart doesn't show the 2008 level, but it's noted in that small box on the bottom, that we saw the volatility in the S&P 500 reach levels that we hadn't really seen since the peak in 2008 in the heat of the great financial crisis. And that was levels that we've not seen since. I mean, these are sort of bookends, 2008 and March of 2020. And you can see the average has been pretty low. So while we've seen these little spikes, volatility has been really low, especially between 2016 and 2018. We saw a little bit more elevated from 18 on, but, you know, nothing like what we've seen recently. And as I mentioned, it was the fastest bear market correction in the record of the S&P 500 at 15 days, which made it very difficult for many asset owners to rebalance. And rebalancing when a market declined that rapid, especially given the strains that we saw coming into the fixed income market in terms of the bid-offer spreads for even U.S. Treasury securities, made it really difficult to execute in the cash markets for bonds to rebalance. So it was a particularly challenging time, not only because the market was falling so quickly, but that the capital markets started to kind of seize up. And that's when the Fed had to step in with the cut in rates and the massive injection of liquidity. If we could turn to the next page, non-U.S. equities were not spared. In fact, in a typical risk-off environment, we saw within U.S. equities, smaller caps underperform large caps. And what you typically see in a big risk-off environment like we saw in March was that international equities would underperform U.S. equities. And in addition, as you might expect, we saw a strengthening of the U.S. dollar and the Japanese yen as reserve currencies. So the ETH index was down almost 23%. That's the developed markets outside the United States. And you can see on the left-hand side of this chart that Austria, I mean, just everything was down. Switzerland is sort of a safe haven, was down only 12%. But emerging markets actually did a little worse than the ETH index, with Brazil down 50%. Ironically, this struck us as that China, which was sort of the ground zero, if you will, for the coronavirus, was only down 10%. So emerging markets managers who had been underweight China for the quarter actually underperformed, which seems counterintuitive given the fact that their economy had been dramatically slowed down during the quarter, although we may see some of that roll into the second quarter. So if we could turn to the next page, just take a quick look at what happened with the bond markets. And on the right-hand side, this chart shows the 10-year Treasury in blue, the 2-year in orange, and the 6-month to give you a really indication of what was happening sort of in the money market world in green. And you can see that rates rising coming through 2018. And then you can see this just unbelievable fall in rates across the curve. So not only did the 10-year fall, but the six-month, I mean, everything fell. And it was just a cliff. It just everything just kind of went off a cliff. Of course, the Fed fired a big shot immediately by dropping the Fed funds rate by a full percent, which has a much bigger impact on the short end of the curve, the 6 months, if you will. But you can see everything fell as investors sold equities and bought treasuries and bought safe haven currencies. The aggregate actually held up pretty well, which is the sort of a representation of the broad fixed income market. It rose 3.2%. It would be our initial performance from active bond managers in the core and core plus space is that most of them are going to post either very modest positive returns or negative returns because most of them came into the first quarter holding a lot of investment grade credit. And for core plus managers, they were holding below investment grade credit. And of course, the OPERF portfolio has a combination of U.S. treasuries, a layer of active core managers, and then some below investment grades. So when Jim gets to the sort of forensics on how we think the markets will impact the OPERF portfolio, you'll see that any investment grade credit or below investment grade credit was really a negative for the quarter. Treasuries were the only segment of the market that did really well, and mortgages kind of held in there. And as I mentioned before, that the seizing up of the markets made transacting for your managers and for your internally managed portfolios difficult, especially during March before the Treasury and the Fed stepped in with all their liquidity measures. So let's turn to page six. So on page six, this just shows market rebounds, how swift and powerful, and back to sort of a comment that Alan made, which is you stay the course, and this is kind of a testament to why you stay the course, is that trying to trade the markets and calling the bottom is incredibly difficult. You only know the bottom when you're past it. You don't know it when it's coming. You have no idea when it's going to come. So you rebalance, you stick to your discipline, and you stay in the markets. And with these, in what's good to remember, too, is that having a more conservatively positioned portfolio and cutting off that sort of left tail risk is due to the fact that a market decline of 34%, which we saw the Russell 1000 do peak to trough, takes a fairly significant increase in the markets to get back to normal, a 43% increase to get back to the same level you were given a 34% decline. So you want to stay in the market and rebalance. I mean, these are just sort of the blocking and tackling of institutional investment. Let's turn to page seven. And this is so out of date now. And this was April 9th. As you can see on April 9th on the far right-hand side what the price of oil was doing. April 9th, the price of oil was $22 a barrel, roughly, and now it went, I mean, on April 20th, it went to minus 40 due to some difficulty in storing oil in Cushing, Oklahoma. I don't think this has ever happened where oil prices actually reached a negative $40 a barrel. It's back positive, but it's barely positive. And again, it had to do with some technicals around the May oil contracts, but the June contracts that had been trading at about $26 a barrel is now, you know, in the teens or below. So oil prices are really volatile given the complete evaporation of demand globally with everybody in their homes, nobody driving, factories closed, businesses closed, planes not flying. So we saw a complete collapse in demand when we already were coming into this year with a lot of supply. So we had this huge supply. You had Russia and Saudi Arabia arguing over prices, so pumping oil like crazy, the U.S. pumping oil like crazy, And then you had this complete collapse in demand, and so the prices just completely fell. Now, the reason why this matters is for a lot of reasons. For one thing, it impacts some of the producers in the emerging markets. It also impacts energy within your portfolio, which can be in multiple places in your portfolio. It's clearly in your equity portfolios, your public equity portfolios, but it's likely to have some exposure potentially within your real estate portfolios and also within your private equity and real asset portfolios. So this is kind of pervasive and clearly a problem. The expectation is that we'll force a lot of the frackers in the United States out of business. And so what are the knock-on effects of that in terms of what the oil production could look like going forward is kind of an unknown. So we're going to move on to a different section here and look a little bit at the economic impact. And hopefully this won't overlap what Alan said too much, but I think it's really important to think about what is going to change going forward. So that's all history. So there are three different places I want to talk about how things could be changing behaviorally: households, corporations, and governments. And Alan sort of talked a little bit about this, but if you think about how traumatic an event and how severe this event is, it permeates just every part of our lives. And I recognize and I applaud Alan for raising this issue of income inequality. This has really been inordinately impactful on minorities and low-income people in the United States who have not very good access to quality health care. And households have no savings. So this is another thing where the pension and having 401k plans and all these other things are so important, is that households don't have savings. So they have less than $400 in savings to manage through a crisis like this. And, of course, with the unemployment rates that we're seeing, you know, there's going to be a lot of individuals that are going to be in a lot of pressure. But the other things that are going to happen is less travel overall, and social distancing is probably going to be here for a while, and people aren't driving as much. So insurance costs change, consumption of oil changes, consumption in general changes, and if you don't leave your house as much, you probably don't spend as much. And U.S. GDP is 70% consumer spending. So we can certainly expect to see our GDP take a fairly big hit. If you look at corporations and how they're behaving, they're preserving cash. They are accessing the debt markets now, which is helping them to get additional cash to tide them over during this particularly bad period, which who knows, it could last a year or so. And they're also being able to get some federal assistance, and we'll talk about that in terms of payroll protection. But probably less travel, more video conferencing, staggered work schedules, working from home. The other things that impact the equity markets is they're not going to be doing as many buybacks. Buybacks have been on fire over the last 3 or 4 years. They're probably going to lower dividends. So there is an impact on public equities at some point. And governments, as Alan noted, are going to have a lot of debt. So are we facing a debt crisis 3 or 4 years down the road? So let's just move to the next page, and I'll go through some of these relatively quickly so we can make sure Jim has time to talk about the portfolio. But the unemployment claims spike is just unprecedented. This chart only goes through March 28th, but after March 28th, we saw the April 4th and 11th numbers come in at 6 and 4.8 million respectively. So we saw an additional 10 million come in after this chart was put together. That's pretty phenomenal. That's 22 million between after 3/14. So that's just crazy. October unemployment was 10%. The outlook now for U.S. unemployment by the end of the second quarter is to potentially reach 15% and 19% in 12 months. And we're only up to 4.4% in March. So these forecasts are for some pretty dire unemployment figures. So looking at page 10, the reason why the government is so anxious to bail out and provide funding and payroll relief and lending and grants to small and medium-sized businesses because they employ the bulk of the people in the United States. 83% of the payroll in the U.S. is by small and medium-sized companies. So these federal bailouts are particularly important for U.S. employment that we support these smaller companies. I'm going to skip 11 and 12, which are sort of anecdotal, but I think we all know it. U.S. airline passenger traffic just collapsed. If you look at page 13, it shows the open table restaurant reservations. No one's going out to eat. And let's turn to page 14 because I think this one kind of tries to bring some of this home, if you will, in terms of what areas of the market will be most heavily impacted by the social distancing. So the winners so far have been streaming services like Netflix, of course. They added, I think, 15.7 million paid additions in the month of the first quarter, which is just extraordinary. Their average is generally closer to 6 or 7 million, but that is their global addition. So people don't have anything to do. They're watching Netflix. So some of the winners are the streaming services. Of course, Amazon is a big winner in this. As people have been ordering, don't want to go out, they order in. Zoom has been a big winner, too, because of the WebExes and online meetings such as this one. Citrix, which does work-at-home software. Clorox, I don't know if you've tried to find Clorox wipes. They're not to be had. Gilead, which is representative of some of the biotech companies that are working on gene sequencing and vaccines. And, of course, Kroger's and other grocery stores who have seen big rushes and hoarding, if you will, or people sort of panic buying and storing lots of especially paper goods. So if you look at the consumer spending by industry in the upper left, you can see retail ex-food and beverages is the bulk of this, that light blue. And that's what's not happening. The retail stuff is not, no stores are open, although there are some states now that are starting to open it. But you can see restaurants and bars, and you can see entertainment and hotels. So these are the areas clearly they're going to be the highest impacted by social distancing. If you look at the employment by industry, those same industries, you can see that restaurants and bars and retail, ex-food and beverage, are the big employers and have closed. Those are the ones who've been closed, which is why we're seeing this enormous spike in unemployment claims. And on the right, back to the S&P 500 earnings, you can see the earnings contribution by industry. So that same light blue area, the retail, ex-food and beverage, restaurants and bars, and then airlines and cruises, in this case, kind of come into the earnings, are the biggest earners in the S&P 500. So if you look at the retail sales number for the month of March, it was down 8.7%. And if you look at the winners and the losers in that, auto sales were down 25%, clothing was down 50%. And then if you look at food and beverage stores, so liquor stores, grocery stores, up 26%. So the winners are clearly the online people that can buy things online, and the brick and mortar are definitely suffering. So if you have to think about how your portfolio is going to do, the public equity portfolio, you kind of have a view into the earnings here. We talked a little bit about page 15, but I wanted to highlight here the Fed policy actions. We talked a little bit about this. They started their asset repurchasing programs. They were initially the QE2, as it's called, quantitative easing 2, the great financial crisis. The Fed was buying $120 billion worth of treasuries a month, and in March they were buying $70 billion a day. That just tells you how much they were injecting liquidity into the fixed income markets. And, of course, they've introduced the asset purchase program to include CMBS. They're supporting ETFs. They're supporting commercial paper and medium-term notes. They're doing everything they can to keep liquidity in the marketplace, especially within these stressed areas of the market. I'll spend just 1 second on page 16, which is the CARE Act, CARES Act, the Corona Aid Relief and Economic Security Act. Ooh, I'm getting an echo. Okay. So the Federal Reserve policies are just listed at the top, and they're numerous, and then they're quantified a bit here at the bottom. Of course, the payment to individuals, the $1,200 checks, the tax grants to business. You can see the size of this. I mean, it's huge, $2.2 trillion, which is roughly about 10 to 11% of the U.S. GDP. So it's a, and there's another one actually now in the works. Senate passed it this morning for an additional bailout for payroll, support for payroll and for small businesses. So kind of looking forward on page 17, what's going to happen from here? These are kind of the range of things that could happen. U-shaped recovery, WL. In all the calls that we've been doing in the investment with investment managers and economists over the last month or so, the most consensus seemed to be gathering around what they call a fall stall surge, which is a U-shaped without the definition of the U, if you will, the bottom. So no one really knows how long we could kind of go along the stall. Because as Alan mentioned too, we're going to start seeing GDP numbers come out, you know, and these things are going to create additional volatility in the market, even though people know this is coming when they see the numbers. I think it's going to be a little bit shocking, especially when we start seeing the unemployment figures. And most managers and economists think that the U, the length of the U, the stall, is going to be dependent on mortality rates, if we can get the spread rates, flattening curves, vaccines, and it's going to determine, it's going to also be based on how much do we see in demand destruction for things versus demand delay. So if you were going to buy a car, do you not buy a car now for a long time, or you just delay when you buy the car? And some of that's going to be based on how quickly we can get people back to work generating income. So I'll stop there and turn it over to Jim, and he can talk a little bit about how all of this is going to impact the OPERF portfolio.
Janet, before you do that, before turning over to Jim, are there questions of Janet? Hearing none, I have one. Inflation is something that everybody pays a lot of attention to. And there's so many different profound changes that move in different directions. The Fed deficits are unprecedented. They would say inflation would increase. The Fed rates are unprecedented low. That would say inflation would increase. But then the commodities, particularly with oil, the collapse in all those commodities, would say we're looking at deflation. So where do you guys come out on that?
Well, inflation, there's so many different things that influence inflation. There's wages, there's capacity utilization within manufacturing, there's liquidity, there's all sorts of things. And as you mentioned, the commodity markets are telling us right now that this is not going to be a problem. And if you look across the manufacturing and you look at wages, it's hard to see how we're going to have any kind of capacity constraints on manufacturing anytime soon. I don't see that with the unemployment rate spiking like it's anticipated to do, that we're going to see any kind of pressure coming from wages. Corporations are going to have a difficult time pushing through price increases because we have an impaired consumer base based on unemployment. So it seems inevitable, John, in the intermediate to longer term, but in the short term, I can't see it.
Well, as you know, the Fed believes that there's a right amount of inflation at roughly 2%. It'd be wrong to have it much higher, and it'd be really wrong to have it lower or negative. So any predictions?
Well, Well, headline inflation includes energy and gas prices, and it's a fairly large component of that. So with the decline in energy prices and gasoline prices, we're going to see headline CPI fall.
Thank you. Any other questions? So, Jim?
Okay. Good morning. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay, great. Hi, great to be with y'all. Just wanted to echo Alan's comments on good wishes on health and spirits for everyone. So just for the record, Jim Callahan with Callan. Janet provided some good context on the markets. I'm going to try to bring that to the OPERF portfolio and what that might mean for performance during the first quarter. As you know, when we report on performance, we always try to focus more on the long term, and this is a very short term period of time. I think it's really important to note up front that when we go through our asset allocation modeling process, we account for periods like this. The portfolio has a long term time horizon to invest. It's designed to weather environments like this. So that's important to keep in context as we go through this. But I'm going to focus my comments really on what the market's behavior might mean to the OPERF portfolio during the first quarter. I think it's important, and I'm going to start my comments here on page 19, just to remind everyone what has been done strategically for the past 5+ years, because a lot of that work was done and it was designed to try to help the portfolio weather environments like this better. There's no way to sidestep them. As Alan mentioned up front, the portfolio has an equity bias. It's necessary to meet the long-term objectives. So there's no way to avoid it. But there's ways to get through it in a better fashion. And a lot of the work that's been done to the portfolio over the last 5 years has been designed to accomplish that. There's a lot of it that was implemented. Unfortunately, not all of it before this event, but a lot of it was captured. And I think it's important to just kind of review what was done strategically to the portfolio before we get into specifics. So, broadly, on an asset allocation basis, there are a couple of things that were done. The first was an increase in the alternative portfolio, and specifically the build-out of a diversifying strategies portfolio. That's, again, not 100% complete, but there's been a lot of progress made there. There is an addition of risk parity to the portfolio as a separate allocation. Again, that wasn't funded, but that was done in design to provide diversification. And the other element to this was there was a strategic decrease in the target for private equity. Still a substantial part of the portfolio, but lowering of private equity and overall equity in the portfolio. So that's what was done at the asset allocation level. And then here on page 19, what we do is we go through each asset class. Because each asset class has experienced some restructuring to try to fulfill each of their roles in the rock band here. So the big thing in the public equity portfolio was the introduction of a low volatility component. I'll talk a little more of that in a second. It has a 25% target for public equity, not funded all the way to that level yet. But certainly some significant progress towards that target. In fixed income, there was an introduction of a sleeve of U.S. Treasuries, which has a target of 37% of the fixed income portfolio that was introduced in 2016. As you know, there was also back in December, the council approved a pretty significant further restructuring of the fixed income portfolio. To increase liquidity, increase downside protection. Again, that wasn't fully implemented as of yet, but that was another structural change. Within the real estate portfolio, the big change there was a shift to core strategies away from more aggressive value add and opportunistic strategies that initiated in 2015, and there's a lot of progress made in that regard. Private equity, which has been a significant and successful part of the portfolio, there's been a lot of structural changes there, consolidation in the number of partnerships and relationships, et cetera. And then finally, the building out of the diversified strategies and the real asset component of the portfolio in alternatives. So again, all of those were designed to really try to help the portfolio weather the market storm better. I'll turn you to page 20. These are preliminary. Yes, please.
It's John Russell. Back to the slide, if you would. To what extent is the fixed income portion tied to the equity market, corporate bonds in particular?
Well, I think typically what happens, and I think if I could, well, let me just make the verbal comment. I can hit on specific numbers later. You know, typically when you get a drawdown in equities, credit within fixed income corporate bond exposure tends to underperform other parts of the fixed income market. Certainly the lower rated the credit, the worse the performance. So we actually did see negative performance from investment grade corporate bonds during the quarter. I believe that the investment grade index was down a little over 3%. High yield bonds were down over 13% during the quarter. So there is definitely a higher correlation to equities amongst high yield bonds. Hence why the new strategic plan for fixed income drastically reduces the exposure within fixed income to credit and specifically below investment grade credit.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'll turn you to page 20. Again, preliminary first quarter performance. It looks like the total fund is down about 7.25% for the quarter. The total fund benchmark was down about 6.3%. And we put some comments here as to kind of what helped, what didn't help in relative terms. The portfolio was underweight public equity relative to target, so that certainly helped as public equity experienced a significant drawdown, as Janet pointed out. Portfolio is overweight fixed income, again, as that is the anchor to windward and the flight to quality, that helped. The portfolio is overweight to private equity, and private equity returns are lagged, as we know. And so when I show asset class performance on the next slide, you'll see we actually are reporting a positive return for private equity for the quarter. And I'll make a few comments on that. Those numbers are definitely lagged. There's also lagged returns for real estate as well. So given that private equity and real estate represent a pretty significant part of the portfolio, over a third, those stale valuations actually help in a one-quarter short period like this. Some of the detractors, as you know, the public equity portfolio has tilts towards certain risk premia, small cap and value being two of them. Both small cap and value underperformed for the quarter, so that was a detractor. And as I just mentioned, the below investment grade exposure within the fixed income portfolio was a detractor, as was the active management exposure, just given that active managers tend to be overweight spread sectors, which are securitized, and credit underweight government sectors, and so active managers by and large underperformed during the quarter as well. So a couple comments on private assets below. As you can see, the write-downs, the changes to appraisals that we're likely to see from private equity and real estate aren't really going to hit in the first quarter. You're going to see those in second quarter and most likely third and fourth quarter returns. So that's just important to keep in mind. Those will kind of get phased in. The expectation is that, you know, real estate markdowns will be swift. Janet didn't spend a lot of time talking about that. You know, I think the word from real estate managers is that, you know, there's just hasn't been a lot of transaction activity. So there haven't been a lot of good marks for appraisers to make adjustments to properties. So a lot of the open-ended core funds that we track and some of which are in your portfolio, they're actually, you know, reporting positive returns for the quarter. Some of the preliminary results that are coming in, again, the expectation is that we're going to see write-downs in real estate. It's just going to be delayed. Private equity marks, same thing. I've heard a couple of different guesses as to what might happen to private equity adjustments, and I think the expectation is that they're going to be in line with public market declines, and in some cases maybe worse, which stands to reason just given that private equity is kind of a, you know, public equity on steroids. So that's just some public, that's some total fund comments. And then the next slide, page 21, I'll make some asset class specific comments. So we go through each of the five major asset classes here. The number that you see in parentheses represents the allocation for the total fund. So public equity at the end of the quarter, 28.4% of the total fund was in public equity. The target is 32%. So again, 32.5%. So again, slightly underweight to public equity, which helped. The portfolio was down 23.5%. The index, which is the MSCI All Country World IMI index, was down 22.4%, so slightly underperforming. As I mentioned, the bias towards small cap and value hurt both in the U.S. and outside of the U.S. The global low volatility strategies, it says should help. They did help. When we put this together, we didn't have the final numbers, but we do now. It looks like in aggregate, the global low vol portfolio was down 18.4%. So again, with the index down 22.4, significant outperformance, still negative, which is expected, but protecting. So doing what was expected to do. And then the final comment here is just that given that the portfolio has a global equity positioning, the overweight to non-U.S. relative to peers may be a detractor when you see peer results down the line. Many public funds have a U.S. bias to their portfolio. Fixed income represented 21.4%. The target is 20%, so again, slightly overweight, which was helpful. The portfolio was positive, had a 1% return. The benchmark, you can see, was positive 2.1, so slight underperformance. The exposure to Treasuries helped. That component of the portfolio was up 8.5%, positive 8.5%, so that's great. Active management in the core part of the portfolio, which represents the bulk of the portfolio, that's 46% of the portfolio. The managers collectively had a positive return. They were up 0.8. But the benchmark, the Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate Index, was up 3.2, so underperformance. And then the below investment grade detracted. That part of the portfolio, what we refer to as big below investment grade, was down 13.3% for the quarter. I made some comments on real estate. Early marks, as the portfolio is up 2.3, the benchmark is 1.3. Again, those valuation adjustments are going to happen in future quarters. The repositioning of the portfolio definitely will have helped, less risky part of the market. And then just a comment there, as Janet said, exposure to some of the sectors of the economy, like retail and entertainment, travel, any exposures to those parts of the portfolio will definitely hurt. Private equity represented 25%, a full quarter of OPERF at the end of March. Portfolio preliminary performance 3.5. That's again a lagged number, as is the benchmark. Energy, any exposure in energy is certainly going to help. Any exposure to entertainment and travel holdings are certainly going to help. We'll see those marks come in shortly. And then the alternatives part of the portfolio, which is up to almost 11%, with a 15% target, again, so the build-out not fully complete, but getting there, held in reasonably well, down 3.2%. Understand that a lot of that portfolio is private, and so, again, some of those valuations may be stale. A couple comments about the diversifying strategies portfolio. Haven't seen final numbers on that portfolio, but there are three main components to that portfolio. One, the biggest chunk of it is alternative risk premia. Those strategies, definitely were affected by market performance. I've seen numbers all the way into the minus low 20s down to the minus single digits. But I think, not surprisingly, there's some dispersion in results there, but I think you're going to see those results be negative. Maybe not as bad as equities collectively, but certainly negative results. Trend is the second component of that portfolio. We've also seen a decent dispersion in results for trend as well, but by and large, trend strategies have done pretty well. That's been the one component that's really helped here. I've seen positive results from managers there for the quarter, so that'll definitely be an element of the portfolio that helps. I have not seen any preliminary performance for the third component, which is what we call other, which currently is systematic global macro type strategies with GMO and Bridgewater. I haven't seen those preliminary results yet. I would expect them to be negative as well. But by and large, again, this portfolio, while negative, is definitely providing diversification at the total fund level.
Jim, if John Russell again, if I may.
Yeah.
While we're on that slide, just a comment. And it's inevitable that we look at market value for assets that we're going to hold for a long time, long-term bonds, real estate, or real estate, and so on. But if you buy those things for income, the value, market value, quarter by quarter, in a sense, shouldn't matter to us, except that the way the world is structured, we have to report it.
Yeah, that's a comment that I think you've made before about, real estate. I think that's one of the reasons why the portfolio was transitioned to have a heavier component to core. Core real estate is intended to achieve the majority of its return over time through income as opposed to appreciation. Hopefully there is some appreciation there over time, but it has a much more heavy income component. As a component of its total fund return. So yes, quarter to quarter, year to year, you can see adjustments in valuations. But if you're a long-term investor and you hold, then the income component should be a very powerful element. And obviously that's the hallmark of fixed income as well.
Go ahead. I didn't
want to. No, that was good timing because that was really the end of any formal comments that I intended to make. I'm happy to try to answer any questions. The next couple of slides are just some more detail on market behavior. 22 just shows the disparity amongst styles within the U.S. I think Janet hit on this before. It's pretty remarkable. The disparity between large growth and small value during the quarter. International returns are for the quarter on page 23. And then finally, and this was a comment I think you made before, John, on sector performance. You know, when you look at the disparity of returns amongst sectors in the fixed income market, that second to last column, again, this was through April 9th, but Treasuries being the best performer, and that's common in the flight to quality, like we've seen, up over 8%, while things like high yield and emerging markets were down sharply.
Any questions of Jim or Janet from council members?
Treasurer, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure whether the question is for Janet or Jim. It might be a little bit unfair, but there's certainly a lot of conversation and discussion about what the shape and duration of a recovery might look like. The Oregon Office of Economic Analysis has started referring to the square root recession, where there's a drop, a recovery to some level that's less than the initial level, and then some level of stability. And I really wonder about that level of stability is where I want to ask you about it. And in particular, what the connection is, in your view, between consistent information and approach as we get towards a recovery and consumer confidence. You mentioned the really significant role of consumer spending. And so how do you see that going forward? We're beginning to see different approaches in different states, but that I'm interested in how you think that might play out.
Well, I'll make one comment and then Janet can add to it, but you know, the market hates uncertainty, right? And one of the reasons that this happened as sharply and quickly as it did was the incredible amount of uncertainty on so many different levels. I think that uncertainty remains. A lot of these questions are hard to answer in terms of, you know, when's the recovery going to happen? How quick is it going to happen? What does it mean? What are the specifics behind it? And as long as there is that, you know, degree of uncertainty, volatility remains high. And it's hard to really make predictions on, you know, on inflection points and things of that nature. So, you know, I don't pretend to have a better crystal ball than anyone else on the specifics of timing and magnitude. But as long as they exist, and I think they still do, I think you're going to continue to get, you know, a decent amount of volatility in the market, which, you know, just from our view, I think, you know, emphasizes the need to be disciplined as an investor. We don't try to pretend to know those types of things. And so we go back and we rely on the fact that we have a long time horizon. We want to be disciplined and rebalancing where we can to the extent that we can take advantage of opportunities in the market where we feel there's some sort of asymmetry in a risk return spectrum. I think that's interesting, and those discussions are ongoing. But trying to predict, you know, economic recovery and market recovery, I think is a challenging thing at the moment.
Further questions?
This is Member Kara Samples. I have a sort of a more global question for really all three of you. It sounds like, you know, over the course of the last 5+ years, we've done a great job or a good job positioning ourselves for an environment like this. And we'll see how it plays out over the course of an entire market cycle rather than just this quarter. But Alan made some comments about, you know, being well positioned for opportunities. And I think that in anything, any sort of recovery outside of a near-term U-shape, there will be a lot of opportunities potentially to take advantage of. And I wanted to just ask about how staff is looking at that and how we are positioned to take advantage of those, because really generally you need to be nimble in order to take advantage of them and also have adequate liquidity. I'm not sure who the right person is, but can somebody make some comments about how we are organized to take advantage of opportunities that might present themselves and where we would do that.
So, Chair Russell, if I may take that question.
Yeah.
So, Member Samples, I think that's a great question, and it's a very important one. So, what I would say is that there's probably two different ways to look at that. First, there are strategic policies that we are following. So each sleeve has longer term plans that are in place. But that said, though, within each sleeve, there is an opportunity to be a little bit more opportunistic. So let's take, for example, the opportunities portfolio, which Mike Mueller is overseeing. He's been taking a lot of meetings recently, along with John Hershey and a few others, focused on the various opportunities within the credit market, for example. A little sort of longer-term, less liquid opportunities within the credit space, because obviously that's a space that might have some sustained opportunity sets. As you just said, Member Samples, instead of a very quick rebound, if we have a sustained situation, those are one of the spaces where we would have time to ramp up our research a little bit more above and beyond what we've already done. And then, of course, within other spaces, there are going to be, again, strategic plans that are already in place, but within that, on the margin, we will also certainly get phone calls from our various manager relationships. Really good opportunities that they are seeing. It might be a co-investment opportunity in private equity, for example. So we are mindful of being opportunistic, but at the same time within the framework of our overall strategic policy.
And if I could add to that, just by its nature, private equity is opportunistic. My understanding is that there's a lot of dry powder in that market, and they are nimble. They don't need our approval to make investments.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Unlike back in the great financial crisis, I think private equity managers this time around definitely have more dry powder on hand.
Thank you. Yeah, that sort of answered my second question, which was Alan made a comment at the beginning about our having plenty of liquidity to meet our existing cash obligations, but obviously if we were doing something outside of our long-term strategic planning here, we would need that dry powder.
Any further questions? Well, thank you to Janet and to Jim and Alan. Tough time frame to analyze. We appreciate that. Next on the agenda is Rex, asset allocations.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Russell. So I think some of these numbers were previously alluded to by Jim Callahan, but these are the asset allocation numbers as of March 31st for OPERF, SAFE, and the Common School Fund. And what you will see is the continued slight under allocation to public equity, a slight over-allocation to private equity. And then most of the other asset classes are pretty close to its target with, again, alternatives investments at a little under 11% versus its target of 15%. And then in terms of SAFE and the Common School Fund, the allocations are pretty close to target. And then this next page is just a slightly different way of looking at the asset allocation numbers versus the actual versus target. And then from there, we'll go into the OPERF NAV. Again, this is as of March 31st, showing the performance of the overall portfolio. From there, next is the SAFE Fund. And then the Common School Fund. And then with that, I will also continue on into the future agenda items. As noted previously, the primary topic for the next meeting will be asset allocation and capital markets assumptions update. We'll also have some recommendations from the fixed income manager group as we continue to make some adjustments to that portfolio. And with that, I will turn it back to you, Chair Russell.
Good. Next item on the agenda is open discussion by council members, staff, consultants.
Mr. Chair, just a general comment, not to to jinx whatever might happen in the next couple of minutes, but I think things have gone pretty well, and it's reasonable to assume that our next meeting is likely to be in something like this format again. So I know I'll be interested in feedback from others who are participating remotely about opportunities to improve incrementally, but from my perspective, this has gone pretty well given our first run at it.
But I do have a comment in open discussion. I don't think there's ever been a time when the macro world is so different than it was even as of the first of the year. And I'm thinking in particular of huge, not only federal deficits, but global deficits. Calls into question whether the dollar will still be the reserve currency of the globe. And I think we ought to be discussing among ourselves how we get that really top quality information, opinions about how to deal with this huge change in the whole in the macro world. So we discuss it among ourselves, but I just want to raise that issue because we're seeing such profound changes. The world in the future isn't going to be at all like it is even today. So, any other comments from members, staff, consultants? So, Rex, tell me how we do with public comment. What's the?
Yeah. So, based on the slight, I guess, limitations of the virtual setting that we have, we are requesting that public comments be submitted in writing. They could be submitted in the Q&A portion of the app, or if you'd like, you could also submit it via email or in writing, either way. So I'm not sure if there were any public comments posted on the Q&A portion of the app or not. Yep. Okay. Yeah. So I am getting word from our producer that we did not receive any public comment via the Q&A piece. We did not receive any public comments via email. That's not to say that we might not get it post the meeting. And to the extent that we do receive anything, we will for sure post it.
Okay. Well, is there a motion for adjournment?
Mr. Chair, I move to adjourn.
Is there a second? I'll second.
Second.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Done. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thanks, everyone.
We're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.